I'm Krista Tippett, and this is First Person, Speaking of Faith, with reflection on the death penalty in America.
Considering what all he's done and the way our family has suffered over it, I don't think it'd be wrong to wish him dead. But you know, the Bible says eye for eye.
In recent years, one by one, major religious traditions lined up to question capital punishment as it is practiced in the United States. They did so in contrast to American public opinion, which strongly supported the June 2001 execution of domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh. Now most Americans say they also support the death penalty for international terrorists. What questions are religious voices raising about the American system of justice? And how might their concerns inform our national soul-searching on policies of state-imposed death?
Timothy James McVeigh has been executed by lethal injection. He was pronounced dead at 7:14 a.m. Central Daylight Time.
The first month after the bombing, I didn't even want Tim McVeigh or Terry Nichols to even have trials. I simply wanted them fried. And then I finally come to realize that the reason that Julie and 167 others were dead is because of vengeance and rage. And when we take him out of his cage to kill him, it's going to be the same thing. We will keep the circle of violence going. Number 169 dead is not going to help the family members of the first 168.
Today on First Person, we'll set aside for and against and consider some of the nuances of religious reflection on the death penalty. We'll engage Dead Man Walking author Helen Prejean and civil rights pioneer Joseph Lowery, and hear some of the reasons they are challenging traditional thinking on this issue. We'll also speak with Rabbi Elie Spitz, who clarifies the original meaning of the biblical eye for an eye passage. But we begin with Debbie Morris, who was furious when Sister Helen Prejean published Dead Man Walking with its compassionate portrayal of a man who had brutalized her.
Dear Sister Helen, thank you for writing to me. I'm writing from my home, my 6-by-8-foot cell. I'm in here 23 hours a day. We don't work on death row. We're special here. They keep us away from the general population of the prison. We're the elite, because we're going to fry.
In the award-winning movie, which was made of Dead Man Walking, the actor Sean Penn plays a character based in part on Robert Lee Willie. 20 years ago, when Debbie Morris was 16 years old, Robert Willie abducted her and her boyfriend Mark, raping her and shooting and torturing Mark. Debbie survived to link her captors with the remote area where police found the body of another young woman, Faith Hathaway. Debbie's testimony led to the arrival of Robert Willie on death row at Angola Prison in Louisiana, where Sister Helen Prejean became his spiritual advisor. Debbie Morris lived through years of despair. Then, on the night of Robert Willie's execution, she realized that this ultimate act of the justice system was not going to close the circle and restore her life.
There is no justice on earth for what happened to me or to Mark or to Faith Hathaway. Justice was not what I needed to heal me. Forgiveness was the only thing that was going to do that.
In 1998, Debbie Morris published Forgiving the Dead Man Walking. She makes the Christian virtue of forgiveness concrete and comprehensible. And as Debbie traces her path out of rage, she offers insight for our reflection on this policy of life and death.
In the midst of the 2 days that I spent with these two men, while we were in the middle of the abduction and the rapes, what I felt was just rage and helplessness. I hated these two men, and I hated them for a long time. You know, forgiveness is not our human nature. It's not our instinct.
So when Robert Willie was sentenced to death, did that feel like the right sentence?
I was conflicted about it from the beginning. My emotions said that I would prefer this man be dead. He had made threats against me from his jail cell, And I believed him.
I remember that in your book somewhere. He had said to someone he was sharing a cell with that he'd slice you up into so many pieces that your mother wouldn't recognize you.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And so, you know, there was a long time, the whole time that he was alive, that the last thing I would think before I would fall asleep at night, the last thing I can ever remember thinking is, please, God, don't let him come into my room. Don't let me wake up and find him standing over me. Please. Yeah. So I was living in fear. So there was a part of me that would have preferred that he be dead. But I just began to feel a huge burden, a huge amount of anxiety. I realized on the night of the execution that I was beginning to panic and become desperate that when this man finally paid the greatest price that he could pay here on earth, his life, that I was going to wake up the next morning and still not be better. Then what is there left for me? And then I realized this was sort of the end of the line. I think the first thing that I had to realize about forgiveness is that I didn't do it for Robert Lee Willie. There was nothing really noble about it. You know, for people who say, oh, wow, you know, you're so incredible. I can't believe that you are able to forgive. It wasn't like that. I did it actually very selfishly because I was looking to feel better myself. And I think that, you know, the first thing that you'll see is that the person who does the forgiving is the primary beneficiary. The night that I realized that I needed to forgive Robert Lee Willie, he certainly didn't benefit. He was electrocuted to death. He never knew that I forgave him. He didn't get let off of any hook because I forgave him. Really, I guess I let myself off the hook. And then I think another thing to remember is that it doesn't always look like immediate recovery, immediate healing. Just because you decide to forgive, it doesn't mean it's going to automatically happen. I mean, it's work. It's something that many times you have to will yourself to do, even though you don't feel like it. You have to do it in your head first, having faith that your heart's going to follow.
And still, you know, what are we talking about? When you forgive him, you no longer hate him? Are you changing the way you think about him or what he did to you? What's changing?
I think it means trading away the hate and being filled up with something better for me. Yeah, I definitely think that it means that I have to relinquish the hate. Does it mean that, you know, I would have lunch with him? No. I don't think I ever would have gotten to the point that I even would have wanted to see Robert Lee Willie. And he would not have been a safe person for me to ever see and go through that process with, for me to, you know, to openly, overtly, you know, go through the act of forgiveness with. Some forgiveness is not done with the other person. And, you know, I just think it would be really terrible if just because another person never said they were sorry or really was remorseful for the things they had done, that we would have no way out of the hate and the pain. You know, I think God gives us a different way. He says forgive, and he doesn't say sit around and wait till this other person is really sorry. Sit around and wait till they've suffered long enough. He says forgive them, and there is immediate benefit to that. There's not immediate, total, complete healing. That's going to be a process.
When I read your account of what happened to you, I couldn't help but be struck by how terribly emotionally stunted Robert Willie was. the way he seemed to think that, you know, you might be his friend or even his girlfriend after this happened, that he did not have any concept of what he was doing. And I wonder if, you know, how being a teacher, working with children who may have their own problems at home, and being a mother, has that done anything to change the way you think about Robert Willie as a person?
Oh, in both of those roles in my life, yes. My heart has definitely been softened towards Robert Willie. My first 2 years teaching, especially, I taught children with behavioral and emotional problems down in Louisiana. And, you know, these were the kids who had been kicked out of regular classes, and most of them had been kicked off their little league teams, and, you know, they were about an inch away from being kicked out of the school altogether, and, you know, my classroom was their last stop. And every morning, you know, these kids that some of the other teachers just, you know, didn't want anything to do with would walk into my classroom, and I would put my arms around them and hug them and say, you know, boy, am I glad you're here today. And these are kids, you know, several of my kids were in foster homes. A couple of my kids had been physically abused, and who knows what else had happened to them. And mostly all of them lived in poverty. And I wondered sometimes, you know, were they anybody's primary concern? And one day I realized that if Robert Lee Willie had been a student in my school during this time, you know, he had had a history of having learning problems and stuff.
Yes.
He would have been in my classroom. And he would have walked through my classroom door every day, and I would have put my arm around him and I would have hugged him. And, yeah, I mean, it definitely changed the way I felt about him. Am I making excuses for him? No. Because of all of those students of mine that I had in those first 2 years, two of those little guys have been incarcerated. But there are about 15 of them that have not been. So Robert Willie had choices. So I'm not making excuses for him. But I think it's important for us to go beyond blaming and judging and punishing and start looking for reasons why some people end up giving in to evil, why the evil prevails in their lives, and they end up making the choices that they do.
Promises given and promises broken. Words stain my lips just like blood on my hands. And words are like poison. It sinks down inside you. And some things you do, you just don't understand.
I am not to the point that I think that all executions, all capital punishment is necessarily wrong. I always try to look back to the Bible, you know, for my information, and I think that there are definitely places where it shows that capital punishment was condoned by God. However, we have really messed up that whole system, I think. The way that we are doing capital punishment in this country today is wrong. It's unfair, and we've made so many mistakes. Do I think that it's wrong and that the people who are involved or people who are for the death penalty, do I believe that they are out of God's will? No, I don't. I do think that we need to step back and analyze, you know, is this really the way we want to go? Isn't there a better way? It's easy to be for or against something. But, you know, let it be your neighbor or your uncle, your family member, your child. I watched some footage outside of Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. They were filming the crowd outside at one of the executions, and there was, I believe it was the younger sister of the man who was being executed. Mm. It was his niece. And she was out there outside the gates, you know, protesting against the death penalty. And apparently they were a very close family. And she was, when they came out and announced his death, his time of death, this girl sobbed, I mean, uncontrollably with her whole body. You know what kind of sobbing I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like where your whole body just trembles. And I thought to myself, you know, we've just created another victim. This girl, this young girl, she was like maybe 14 or something. She is now going to have to go through life with that experience. And it's easy to say, well, you know, they shouldn't have raised a killer. Until it hits close to home.
Debbie Morris's book is Forgiving the Dead Man Walking. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is First Person, Speaking of Faith, with reflection on the death penalty.
I lay awake at night a lot of times just sitting there thinking about him, thinking about the things that we used to do as kids. He says he's a born-again Christian, so, I mean, he said, if it comes down to that, he said, I'm ready to go. He wants me and my little half-sister Angie and my half-brother Chad. He wants all of us to be there. And I want to go down there and be with him, but that's going to be hard. And he said he wanted me there. So, yeah, I'll be there.
David Fry, speaking 9 days before his brother, convicted murderer Ronald Fry, was executed in North Carolina in August 2001. The voices of Ronald Fry, his family, and his victim's family provide a window into the larger human dimension of the death penalty issue. Their personal grief, anger, and their need for justice and closure, all of this has become the stuff of our national life since September 11th.
There's always two sides to a story, and each, I guess, believes what they're saying. But the fact of the matter is that Ronnie killed my uncle in cold blood. The death penalty is the only thing that I have. There has to be some sort of closure, and to me, that's the only closure there can be. That's it.
Considering what all he's done and the way our family has suffered over it, I don't think it'd be wrong to wish him dead. But you know, the Bible says eye for eye. I mean, I am a Christian, I believe in God, and I go to church all the time. But in fact, this thing has bothered me so I talked to my Sunday school teacher today to see if I was totally wrong to wish somebody dead. But she said no, said it was not wrong in a case like this. But I think I've made my peace. I think it will ease the pain. It'll just all be over. It'll just all be probably like a bad dream.
Pat Winkler is the sister of murder victim Ralph Childress, who was killed by Ronald Fry in 1993. You also heard her daughter, Christy Hollowell. In national polling, a large percentage of Americans who support the death penalty, like Pat Winkler, quote the Bible, an eye for an eye. But what does that phrase really mean? Ellie Spitz is a rabbi who brings an intriguing background to the capital punishment debate. He is a child of Holocaust survivors, and so he says he knows about the reality of evil which cannot go unpunished. He had an early career as a criminal lawyer. He has written widely on the intersection of faith and ethics, including the death penalty, and has recently published a book about life after death. I asked Ellie Spitz for rabbinical wisdom on our national experience with the death penalty, including the execution of Timothy McVeigh. the worst domestic terrorist in American history and the first person to be executed by the federal government in four decades. But I asked Elie Spitz, first of all, to take me inside the original context of the eye for an eye passage. He explains that it arose in a society in which there were no prisons and no system of justice as we know it. In the Bible, as in much of human history, it was up to family members to avenge crimes against their loved ones.
Ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, appears twice in the five books of Moses, in both Leviticus and in Exodus, and is an example of how you can't understand the Torah, the Bible, literally, that even that line, which seems so straightforward, requires, as the rabbis understood it, requires interpretation. It's about equity. That line is about fairness.
The eye for an eye passage arose not to impose strong punishment, but to limit revenge, as in, you may not slaughter the entire family of the person who did this to you. You may only take an eye for an eye. But even that, the rabbi said, may not always pass the test of fairness.
They said, you know, imagine if a thief had only one eye and put out an eye of a person. Well, in that case, the punishment would not be equal because the thief would have blindness.
Would they be blind? Uh-huh.
And therefore, you can't always have justice with an equal act. Rather, it is best and fairer and more humane to engage in monetary compensation.
Still, the life of a human being created in the image of God is said to be of infinite value. And like many traditional Jews and Christians, Rabbi Spitz insists that the Bible does give civil authorities the right, even the mandate, to impose capital punishment for the crime of murder. When Elie Spitz reflects on his faith, he looks not only to Scripture, but also to the ancient rabbinical dialogue preserved in the Talmud. And the Talmud is even more explicit than the Bible that there must be safeguards to ensure that no innocent person is ever given the irreversible sentence of death. Two eyewitnesses were required to convict in a capital case in the Talmud's original model of Jewish law.
When I'm talking about Jewish law, there's a luxury at play. And here's the luxury. When the rabbis were talking about these ideals, they're doing so without the power to administer justice, and where they're largely the victims. And so therefore, they're talking about ideals. And where I'm very self-conscious is the difference between ideals and how societies operate. And so on the ideal Jewish legal level, it's a life for life.
So it's possible for you, being steeped in Scripture and Jewish tradition, to say that God could condone the taking of a life.
More than condone, I would say God would welcome.
Welcome.
That's right. Because God, throughout Scripture, is concerned about this balance within creation, this balance of justice and balance of fairness. And the taking of a life for a life, capital punishment in some cases, is even more just than keeping a person in prison. But having said that, God also wants the system to be administered justly, because it's even more egregious the taking of a life wrongfully by the state. And that's my problem with the American system at the moment. It doesn't work in practice. I saw that the governor of Illinois recently has reversed himself in terms of being a supporter of capital punishment due to the revelation through DNA testing of how many people were on death row wrongfully. What I learned as a lawyer, back to the personal issue, is that rarely is evidence unequivocal.
So back to the rabbi's wisdom that you have to have two eyewitnesses or...
Absolutely.
Or it doesn't count. I wonder if we could talk about the specific crime of murder, and also note that in the Bible, initially, capital punishment in different forms was prescribed for all sorts of crimes, right? Not just murder.
Oh, yes. Though, again, and now I say it a little defensively, as somebody who holds the Bible dear and a sacred text, all of those claims, like the Bible saying that a rebellious child should be brought to the gates and stoned, the Talmud would say, at least according to a majority opinion, this never occurred nor never would occur. It's simply a warning underscoring the importance of respecting parents. So that sometimes it's there more to emphasize the negative nature of behavior rather than to describe as a code the punishment.
It's very striking to me that the first murder is that of Abel by his brother Cain, and that his life is preserved and protected by God, and he goes on to build the first city.
Right. The first murder of the Bible goes unpunished by mm-hmm. capital punishment. And I think what it does underscore is the gap between an ideal, the ideal of life for life, and the messiness of determining how clear-cut and how cold-blooded an act was that would justify the ideal. And two, it underscores God's own ambivalence in administering justice strictly.
You have written about the survival of the soul, which is an unusual topic to take on within Judaism. Judaism has not been so concerned with the afterlife. And I wonder if you've thought about if death is not the end, and if, as I think is implied in all of our traditions, life and death are great mysteries. What does that say about the morality, the efficacy, you know, the meaning of the death penalty?
Well, interestingly, the rabbis of the Talmud say that that death itself is atonement at times. So they use the example of King David and his act of setting up Bathsheba's husband Uriah for death. And they basically say he was never forgiven in this life for those felonies. It was only when he died that he was fully forgiven. That's not a statement about capital punishment for me, as much as it is a statement that when a person dies, there is some atonement in their own death, even their natural death. And so that even people put in prison for a lifetime, when they die, their death is some atonement. I can't always say full atonement.
I mean, one thing that people were disturbed by in Timothy McVeigh is that he did not seem publicly to go through any regret or any sense of wanting atonement. But, you know, what you're saying is that he may get it whether he wants it or not.
Within the Jewish tradition and within the Christian tradition and other faith systems, there is an accounting at the end of life, a judgment, a life review. And that life review, in the rabbinic description, is identified with experiencing all the pain caused to others. And my hope for Timothy McVeigh is that from the inside, he feels the kind of pain he caused to others, and the outcome will be his own repentance.
Even if that happens beyond time.
Correct. And that's well framed, beyond time.
Eli Spitz is a rabbi in Tustin, California. After a short break, we'll return with civil rights pioneer Joseph Lowry on race, reverence for life, and the geography of execution in America. We'll also hear from the most prominent religious crusader against the death penalty today, Sister Helen Prejean. I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us. Krista Tippett, and this is First Person, Speaking of Faith. Today, revenge and justice, reflection on the death penalty in America.
At 1 a.m., I will go speak with the condemned. I will tell him to prepare for his execution. I will tell him to strip down to his shorts and socks, take off all of his other clothes. I will have an escort team available that will escort him approximately 15 feet from his cell to a gurney. He'll be strapped down with four straps across the legs, chest, waist. Then the chaplain will come in and spend approximately 30 to 35 minutes with the individual. At 10 minutes to 2, I will instruct the execution team to place the individual in the execution chamber. In the meantime, I will contact the Secretary of Corrections and ask him if he's received any information or any other instructions from me. If he gives me the orders to proceed, there is a curtain that is pulled. The executioners are brought in and placed behind the curtain. The inmate is looking out at his witnesses through the glass. You have three executioners, so nobody knows who actually administered the lethal dose. The inmate and I let him know to start with. I'm going to be there with him until it's over, until he's pronounced deceased, and that's pretty much it.
Warden Robbie Lee oversees Central Prison in North Carolina. Thirty-eight American states allow the death penalty, but it has always been most rigorously applied in the southern states and mostly towards those who kill whites. Over the past century, 80% of the men and women who died on federal death row were people of color. Joseph Lowry has been called one of our nation's great black preachers and America's consummate voice of biblical social relevance. With his friend Martin Luther King, he co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and organized the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965. He handed the Selma marchers' demands to Governor George Wallace and later publicly forgave Wallace for ordering troops to attack them. I spoke with Joseph Lowry in Atlanta, where he now lives. He has visited inmates on death row and has followed the history and demographics of capital punishment for the better part of a century. For Joseph Lowry, Scripture does not justify the death penalty. He says this is a public policy which reinforces our worst social problems.
The sanctity of life, very early in my career, was a hallmark of my perspective on faith and on morality and ethics. And I think that has passed on into the death penalty issue, that violates the sacredness of life. I've been amused at the debate between the methodology of executions, whether we should do it by lethal injection or whether we should electrocute him, you know, hang him with a rope and so forth. Yeah. It shows the surface level of our thinking. You know, we're not really concerned about life at its depth. We're concerned about how we kill it, not if we kill it or why should we kill it. We're concerned with style rather than substance.
What about the passages, the biblical passages that people use?
Proof texting.
Oh, so an eye for an eye.
Yes, but they look at the Old Testament.
They look at the Old Testament.
Yeah, they
yes.
forget about a young prophet out of Nazareth who said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye. I say that if a man smites you on one cheek, you turn the other. In other words, you return good for evil. And Martin Luther King said, if we follow the axiom of eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, we'll all end up blind and toothless, you know, and we'll be gumming our food. It's a self-destruct kind of philosophy. But people can take the Bible, you know, and prove anything you like if you go through it and isolate texts out of context and so forth. But the spirit of particularly the New Testament upholds a view of life as sacred. And Jesus' attitude toward the prostitute, toward everyone else, no matter what their background, affirmed, I think, the idea that all life was sacred and worth going after.
You know, in the year 2000, 80% of executions took place in the South.
In the Bible Belt.
And I wonder if you, what is your theology of the geography and the demographics of capital punishment in this country?
The South is the military center. When they talk about closing bases and so forth, they're talking a lot about the South. We are the NRA supporters and bastion of gun and the Second Amendment that they claim gives you the right to bear arms. One of the things I think casts a shadow across the South that it hasn't escaped yet is slavery. And I think slavery gave people a false sense of superiority. They looked down on human beings who differ from them, and they began to rely on whatever means necessary to defend that way of life. And it's so ironic that that section of the country that claims to glorify the Lord also crucifies his spirit and his message, I believe. That's the dilemma, I think. The Bible Belt is where we are the killing belt. And I blame demagogic politicians a great deal for this because they strike fear in the hearts of people about crime. And ironically, the chief victims of crime are not white people. The chief victims of crime are black people. And we are seeking relief from it. And this self-preservation, self-protection kind of thing has overlooked the fact that most of the people, you know, that they execute are African American and poor. Mm-hmm. And the criminal justice system in this country, including the death penalty, is the least impacted by social change. The criminal justice system of 2001 is not too very different from the criminal justice system of 1901.
I'd like to know how you experienced the McVeigh execution, because I think for a lot of people, even religious people who are generally opposed to the death penalty, this person who committed treason as well as murder and who murdered so many people is perhaps the kind of exception you could hold up to justify this.
Well, it was interesting. I found McVeigh's remarks interesting in that he was emulating his government. He was at war with his government, and he used analogies of war itself. And I think he ought to stimulate a lot of thought in the American people as we look at how do you justify the killing people when your aim and your claim is that you want to stop killing. But you set the example of killing. The government, when it kills, affirms that it's all right to resolve your problems by taking a human life. And that trickles down. A lot of other things don't trickle down, but that does trickle down, I think, to, as I told Wallace, you rave and rant from the governor's chair, but this guy on the street has no such platform, so he raves and rants with lead pipes and shotgun. And we've sown the wind, and we're reaping the whirlwind. Our children are little McVeighs. They come to school killing teachers, killing other students, and then themselves.
And you really believe that there's a connection?
I do. I don't see how in the world we can separate the fact that officially we take human life to react to a social problem. I've asked people in debate, I said, well, would you pull the switch? No, hell no. Lady told me. I said, why not? Blah, blah, blah. I said, well, you are pulling it. He's pulling it on your behalf. Don't ever forget that, my dear.
You know, for some people, I think Timothy McVeigh seemed easier to kill because he showed so little remorse.
Well, it's not for us to judge. You can have an opinion, but I think we have to take the high road. And from Christian perspective, I think we ought to respect the possibility of redemption. I don't think we have much choice in that.
Joseph Lowery is Chairman Emeritus of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and convener of the Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is First Person, Speaking of Faith.
November 17th, that I've been on death row. There's no contact visit here unless you have the execution day. Then you can have that one contact visit that day, the day before the execution. I've been wanting to get my brother in a bear hug. I told him I'd get him in a bear hug. I'm not going to let him go. You know, but it's going to be nice. You know, it'd be nice to be able to hold him. Bothers me to be away from my family. But I mean, you know, this isn't the final journey, I guess you might want to say. It's just, like I said, I don't fear death. I'm not afraid of it. I gotta die someday. When I was young, I wanted to be a fireman. But that was just a kid's dream, I guess. What would I be doing now if I wasn't here? I have no idea.
Ronald Fry fatally stabbed his landlord in 1993. He died by lethal injection in Raleigh, North Carolina, on August 31st, 2001.
Let me tell you something. One of the great discoveries of my life has been that sometimes you find God where you least expect to find God.
Sister Helen Prejean was 40 years old when she was first asked to become a pen pal to a man on death row, Elmo Patrick Saunier.
I come on to death row. The first visit, I'll never forget. My heart was beating. My fingertips were cold. I had a cold ice band in my stomach. And this man that I'd been writing to, Patrick Saunier, I mean, in the back of my mind, I think I had the image of a monster. And here the guard brings in this man, all chain, hands, legs. And he brings him into this booth, and I look through this mesh screen. I went, oh, my God, he's a human being. I looked into his eyes, and he was smiling, and he said, "Sister, you came. I'm so glad to see you." I couldn't believe how human he was. And you kind of like your soul's a magnet moving, and this, I guess, is what compassion does in us, allows us to experience goodness in people, even in people who have done unspeakable evil. There is more to every human being than the evil they have done. Me too, all of us. We're more than the worst act of our lives, all of us.
In 1993, Sister Helen published Dead Man Walking, about how her life and faith were changed when she became spiritual advisor to two men on death row. The film Dead Man Walking focused on the humanity of a death row convict. But Sister Helen's book was a theological reflection on the human frailty of the whole criminal justice system. Over the last 20 years, Sister Helen says she has witnessed a remarkable convergence of religious values and the secular human rights movement worldwide. She has also seen the demise of the conservative-liberal religious divide on the death penalty, partly through high-profile cases such as the 1998 execution of Carla Faye Tucker, the first woman to be put to death by the state of Texas since 1863.
You know, I began to write to Pat Saunier on death row in 1982, and then witnesses execution in 84, then Robert Willie in 84, then Willie Celestine in 86, and then two more since. And, you know, you come to this crystal clear understanding. What makes the death penalty possible? We have to turn a switch in our soul somewhere that person is not human the way we are. It's what makes all forms of prejudice, however, that happens there too. Oh, well, you know, those, and they used to say this in the Jim Crow days in the South, well, they don't feel like we feel. They don't have the same sensibilities that we feel. This is the only language, you know, they understand. And so once you put yourself in that position as a society of saying, some among us are not as human as the other, and we can dispose of them. We're in a very dangerous moral position.
You know, Carla Faye Tucker is a particular person who died on death row, who brought a lot of people who'd been for the death penalty for religious reasons around to seeing this subject in a different way, at least in her case. And I believe that you got to know her. What was it about her? What did she do that was different?
Carla, you know, Carla had that beautiful, sweet face. She had done an unspeakable crime of killing those two people under drugs. She even stole a Bible. She didn't know they gave you a Bible in the prison, and she stole one. And she began to read the Gospels and learn about Jesus. And everybody over the 14 years of knowing Carla, everybody, the warden, the guards, the other inmates, knew that she was a transformed person, that she was a loving person. And that came through. And see, what made Carla's death different, she was on Larry King for like, what, 2 hours? She was in everybody's living room, and they could hear this woman talk. Now, on one side, they know the terrible crime. She killed two people with a pickaxe while she's under the influence of drugs and bragged about it afterwards and said it made her sexually high. They got that on one side of their souls. And here's this woman talking about love and compassion and how sorry she was for what she'd done, but now she would spend the rest of her life trying to love other people. And how do you put those two things together? It was hard to kill Carla Faye Tucker, and even the head of the Clemency Board of Texas, I was up against him on a national television thing, and he said, we can't be making exceptions because someone found Jesus. Transformation of a human life had nothing to do with the death penalty. They were freeze-framing Carla Faye Tucker in the worst act of her life. Then they were freeze-framing themselves and having to kill her. And that's why the death penalty is not morally good for us.
There's a theological perspective that allows you to make that observation, right?
Sure.
It can't be built into the legal system that human beings change and can be transformed.
But you know what can be built into the legal system? The heart and nub of it all? Dignity for the human person. How can you say you're upholding the dignity of a person when you're torturing and executing them? There's no way there's any dignity in that. And that's what? That's a Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations. Article 3, every human being has a right to life. Article 5, no human being shall be subjected to degrading punishment or torture. That, our law, can begin to embody. And that's what we must work for. I think that the death penalty position is a litmus test of the image people have of God. And there are a number of us out there that really do believe in this vengeful, eye for an eye, pound of flesh, a death for death God.
But this is so hard because your God of compassion is also going to forgive them, right?
That's right. Doesn't mean it won't be an honest conversation in there before that happens. And you know what? I used to have that same image of God. I used to have an image of God that was fearful. I mean, and raised in Catholic theology before Vatican II, it was like you do good and God's going to reward you in heaven. That's going to be real great. Then the punishment was so fierce if you fell into what Catholics call a mortal sin, a grievous sin. I was scared to death of God. I started out that way. I understand that. But that isn't the God I believe in now. And I believe as love grows in us and truth grows in us, I think our God grows too.
Sister Helen Prejean is chair of the National Moratorium Campaign. Earlier in this hour, you heard the Reverend Joseph Lowry, Rabbi Ellie Spitz, and Debbie Morris, the author of Forgiving the Dead Man Walking. It could be said that as Americans, we all became victims of violent crime on September 11th, 2001. And now the death penalty debate touches on important dimensions of the path we are walking as a society, not only as we consider capital punishment for foreign terrorists, but also as we pursue justice, restoration, and healing for ourselves as a nation. Is there a place for forgiveness in our national life, even as we hold those who do violence accountable for their crimes? As we've heard, there is a difference between revenge and justice. And there are moral costs and moral requirements when we establish policies of life and death. In this new global era, what does an eye for an eye mean in America today? We'd like to hear your thoughts on today's program. Please send us an email at mail@npr.org. That's M as in Minnesota, mail@npr.org. Just mention first person when you write. You can also contact us through our website, firstperson.info. While you're there, you can listen to this program again, as well as longer versions of some of today's conversations. That's firstperson.info. You can also call Minnesota Public Radio at 1-800-228-7123. The stories of death row convict Ronald Frye, his family, and his victim's family came from 360degrees.org, a website examining multiple perspectives on the U.S. criminal justice system. Support for First Person is provided by a grant from the George Family Foundation, funding innovative ideas in integrative medicine, education, and spirituality in everyday life. First Person is produced by Marge Ostrushko and Brian Newhouse. Our technical director is Alan Strickland, with assistance from Craig Thorson and Michael DeMarc. First Person's executive producer is Bill Buesenberg. I'm Krista Tippett, and this program is a production of Minnesota Public Radio.